and welcome to this episode of We Didn't Start the Fire. My name is Theo Priestley, and with me today is Kevin J. Anderson, the author. Kevin has published more than 165 books, 56 of which have been national or international bestsellers. He has written numerous novels in the Star Wars, X-Files, and Dune universes, as well as his original works including The Saga of Seven Sons, the Terra Incognita trilogy, and the Saga of Shadows trilogy. Yeah, it's been maybe around 2 years now since the last time we spoke. I remember we spoke around the Gateway concept, which was going to look at Frederick Pohl's novel.
I mean, we're just being in the creative fields, both you and I, in different aspects of it. We kind of intersect and cross paths, and of course, I follow your snarky comments on Twitter every once in a while, and we're just all a big creative web here, and now the web's a little bit tangled. But you know, the thing about being isolated thanks to the coronavirus is I don't have any excuses to tell people I can't be on your podcast because I'm traveling right now. So we ran out of excuses. I got onto your podcast, and I'm very thrilled to be talking to you again, Theo, after all this time.
How has the pandemic affected your schedule and your life so far? I mean, it must be quite hard to, I guess, think and write almost with all the calamity that's going on.
Well, it's almost on two sides of the issue here, that in a certain way, because I'm a writer and I do all my stuff by emailing or by telephone or Zoom or Skype or everything, I mean, my daily work is not like somebody who has to go to, say, a construction site or work at a post office or something. I'm here. I'm writing. I'm editing. My method of writing is to go out walking and dictating, and we could talk about that in a little bit if you want. So all of my process hasn't changed all that much. But on the other half, though, a big substantial part of what I did all year long was I would travel out and be in public, and I would give talks, and I would sign autographs, and I would meet fans. I'd be on panels, and I'd appear at various comic conventions and science fiction conventions and pop culture gatherings. And that was like a third of my income was selling books and doing talks at, say, futurism conferences or banking conferences. And all of that just is almost like running into a brick wall. It all just stopped instantly. It didn't slow down. It just stopped right away. So, I mean, I had just in this past month, I was supposed to appear at a big pop culture convention in Kansas City. And then the week after, I was supposed to be in Dallas. And the week after that, I was supposed to be in Hollywood for a week where I was teaching a writer's workshop, and I was supposed to be handing out awards. All of that went away. Next month, I was supposed to be having a whole book signing tour and historical tour of Ukraine. And I was even going to be receiving an honorary doctorate at the University of Kyiv. Well, all that's gone. And a whole bunch of our plans have just stopped. And you know, part of me feels very unsettled to try to think, well, what's going to happen in August, and what's going to happen for all of my fall bookings, and what about next spring? And we have all kinds of things coming up, but I find that it's just too unsettled and changing so dramatically. I can't realistically plan for more than like a week at a time. And so part of that just shuts down, and I just focus on what I'm doing tomorrow and keeping busy. But as a writer, I've got lots of different projects and telling stories, and maybe my great story about an unsuspected pandemic sweeping across the world is not the best idea to write right now. So I've got giant space operas and other things.
Do you think you could actually draw on some of the lessons that we've seen that are happening across the world in different countries, how different governments are reacting? And does that almost fuel some inspiration in terms of, so you speak about space operas, and one set was the Saga of Seven Sons, which took me an absolute age, but I absolutely loved and devoured every book. But and that was full of politics and intrigue and huge amounts of world building. Are there lessons from all of this that you've seen around the world that you can actually take into some of your books?
Well, I find, like, in the big space operas, or I write the novels in the Dune universe with Brian Herbert, and I'm doing some graphic novels based on Frank Herbert's Dune right now, adapting it into a comic format. So all those, I like dealing with politics and big issues and big environmental and societal issues, but at a far enough remove that no matter where you are in the political spectrum, you can sort of receive the message that I'm trying to say. I mean, if I did a commentary about Boris Johnson or about Donald Trump or today's reactions, you'd get people polarized and split and arguing about the details. But if I set similar politics 500 years in the future in a galactic empire, well, then people aren't so immediately vested in it. But to get to your question about whether I can draw anything from the current situation, I will kind of turn around and do a little bit of a rant here, because it's actually discouraging on the other end, in that science fiction has been painting this picture since the 50s. We've been talking about stuff like this. We've been warning about stuff like this. We've been telling people how to prepare for things like this. And now when I hear, well, we'll get into the little politics. We had one of President Trump's advisors said, nobody ever dreamed that this could happen. We never expected anything like this. Well, I call bullshit. We've been saying this for a long, long time. And there were experts that say it. There were plans in place. They just, when it came actually down to it, nobody did what they were supposed to do. And they all went dithering around. We had a similar thing at 9/11 when the planes flew into the World Trade Center towers. And President Bush was our president at the time. And one of his advisors said, who would ever have thought something like this would ever happen? And of course, Tom Clancy had a number one international bestseller where exactly that happened. And there was an episode of The Lone Gunman, the X-Files TV show spinoff, where a terrorist did exactly that. And there were like a dozen other books where somebody predicted exactly that. So let's just not say that nobody ever thought this would happen. As writers, it's our job to think of all sorts of bad shit that could happen. And not that I'm saying everybody should listen to everything we say, but please don't say nobody ever imagined it.
So going back to your how your process works and how you go for inspiration, you mentioned that you go for works and you dictate. Can you maybe sort of walk through, you know, a day in the life of Kevin J. Anderson, for example?
Well, let's do a fantasy version of it, as in back when days were sort of normal and stable, and we can do it that way. But I live in the Rocky Mountains in Colorado here in the United States, and it's a very beautiful outdoors. I can look out my window and see Pikes Peak, which is a 14,000-foot mountaintop, all covered with snow now. And just yesterday, we got about 3 inches of snow. So all of our pine trees have a nice little white blanket on it. But the sun is out and the sky is blue. And we've got lots of hiking trails just in the immediate neighborhood. And within 5 miles, I've got national forests and huge wilderness areas that I can just go out walking and hiking. I learned a very long time ago that I'm much more creatively inspired when I'm outside and I'm kind of getting inspired by the beauty of forests and trees and mountains and creeks and waterfalls. And there are actually a lot of studies that show that creativity increases when there's physical movement, when you're not just sitting in a chair and staring at a screen, when you're actually out walking and doing things and burning some energy. So for a very long time, I would kind of go out and mull over my fiction and think about what I wanted to write about. And I started taking a recorder with me just to jot down notes to use that as a way of capturing some of my the brainstorming ideas that I have. And I got quite pleased with doing it that way, that I would go out and sort of map out the detailed choreography of multiple storylines in one of my space operas, or just lay out blow by blow a giant space battle or some epic fantasy naval battle or something like that. And I got to the point where I was writing down such detailed notes that they were practically a first draft. And then I sort of made the transition in my mind of, well, why not make it a first draft? And practically for maybe 25, 30 years now, that's how I've been doing my writing, is I'd take the notes of what was going to happen in chapter 7 and chapter 8 of a book that I'm writing, and just go find an isolated, quiet trail to be walking on and just tell myself the story. So instead of thinking up the sentence and typing it on a keyboard with my fingers, I think up the sentence and then I just speak it in words. And, you know, we all know lots of people that just say things out of their mouth, whatever that comes into their head. Well, I kind of make a profit out of it. I write my books that way. And it lets me get outside. I get to see things. I mean, hiking is one of my great loves. And so this way I can go hiking and also be at my day job. So it's at the same time. My office is a trail in the Rocky Mountains, which is, I think, much better than my little office that I'm sitting in right now talking to you.
That's quite an office environment, for sure. Do you think writers in general then sort of fall into a kind of almost analysis paralysis, where they write something because they believe that they're most creative at a desk, for example, that they write something, look at it, and then spend almost eternity editing and re-editing till it becomes perfect as a draft? And they should, you know, like you say, go out with notes, flesh it out on the fly, come back, script it out, and then leave it at that, and then so don't return to it, or keep returning to it, but only for reference only? I mean, what's the sort of, is there a best way, or is everyone different?
Well, everybody's different. So that, I mean, that's the worst part about writing advice, to tell people that this is the only way to do it. But what I do like to say is that it is another way to do it. And you should, you know, try all the different recipes of baking bread before you try one recipe and say, this is the only way to bake bread. You can tell it's nearly lunchtime here, so that's why I'm thinking of that. I've talked to a lot of people who would tell me, I tried writing by dictation once for about 5 minutes and it just didn't work for me, so I gave it up. And I kind of counter that with, it's a learned skill, just like typing is. You didn't sit down at your keyboard for 5 minutes and say, I just can't write this way, I'm never going to do it again. You have to learn how to do it. And dictation is no different. You have to learn not to be self-conscious thinking and speaking your sentences out loud. But, you know, one of the things that the example that you're doing is a perfect example, that, like the one you just mentioned, where you'd be typing things and then you look up at it and decide, oh, I got to correct that spelling or change the grammar or rewrite the sentence. In the creative process, in the writing process, they're like two halves. There's the creative part where you're making stuff up. You're inventing the dialogue. You're describing the scene. You're telling the action. You're putting the words down. And then there's the analytical side, where you're actually looking at the words and thinking, you know, is that the best adjective, or is that spelled right, or did I get Napoleon's birthday correct? I should look that up. If what you're doing is this creative part for two sentences and then slamming on the brakes, going into the analytical part and then changing the punctuation or looking up a fact on Wikipedia and then going back and being creative for two more sentences, you're going to get whiplash. You're going from the fun part, which is the creative part, to the boring part, which is the analytical part, at least from my point of view. You don't want to go back and forth and back and forth. If you're out dictating, you have to just go into forward momentum. You got to tell one sentence, then the next sentence, then the next, because you can't go back and add a comma somewhere 2 minutes earlier on your digital recording. You just have to tell the story. And I feel that for me is the most efficient way of just writing. And I'll go out for, you know, miles and miles, and I'll just, my daily normal productivity is about 4,000 words without pushing anything. That's just like my normal routine. I'll go out in the morning and do my couple of chapters and 4,000 words. And then I email the file off to my transcriptionist, And within a day or so, I'll get a Microsoft Word file back of all the words that I said. And then I spend time doing the analytical part of the process, going over the edits and cleaning up and deleting all my repetition. And, you know, it's not perfect the way I dictate it. I'm pretty good because I've been doing this for so many years, but it's not like it comes back from the typist and I send it off to the publisher. It does require a little bit of polishing, but hey, I got to go out and climb a mountainside to see a waterfall while I was writing that chapter, rather than sitting with my butt in a chair and looking longingly out the window, wishing I could be outside.
I have to admit, I'm going to actually have to try that. And the main reason being is that I started a chapter, the first chapter of a book I didn't intend to write, or had no idea that I was going to write. And then I went back to it the next day and then completely redid that chapter. And I felt like, although there was slight momentum and improvement, I probably spent more time doing the re-edit and the rejigging of that single chapter than I did actually bashing out the very first rough draft. So I think I'm going to take some tips out of that. And one of them is actually go out, because I live about 10 minutes away from, 10 minutes walk away from Arthur's Seat, which is one of the big large hills in Edinburgh, where I live. And I went wandering around there yesterday, and it didn't actually occur to me that that is probably one of the best environments to literally walk and think and dictate at the same time. So I'm going to take something away from that one.
Well, and you know, that is something that you can still do, even with the coronavirus, is that we're allowed to go out, at least here, we're allowed to go outside and walk the dogs or go on a bike path or I mean, as long as you're not crowded with people. And I'm choosing trails where nobody else goes, so I could be all by myself. And it's very useful for my soul at a time like this, when there's so much stress every time you turn on the news, or you realize that you don't even want to go to the grocery store because it's like entering a war zone, trying to get your milk or your eggs or something like that. But also, I mean, we could go on for an hour, but because I got asked so many questions about this method, I finally put it all down into a book called On Being a Dictator. So for $5, you can get a whole book with all of my techniques and all of the advice and all the suggestions on it. So if you're interested in learning more. And one of the cool things is I used as an actual example, I've got a vampire serial killer book that's coming out. In fact, it's supposed to be published this month in the UK by Severn House. It's called Stake, like pounding a wooden stake through somebody's heart. It's a serial killer who believes in vampires, and he may or may not be right, but he goes around and finds people that work the night shift and sleep during the day, and he thinks they're vampires, so he breaks into their house and kills them. But what I did in the On Being a Dictator book is I included as an appendix my notes, my little paragraph or so description of chapter one. And then I included the actual transcription of my dictated chapter one, like word for word, the way it came back from the typist. And then I included the edited version. So you can basically see the notes and see the first draft and see the final draft. But also I put a link in there and I made my audio file available. So you can use the link in the book and go directly to my audio of me out there dictating sentence for sentence as I'm out walking or driving or whatever it was I was doing during that chapter. So it's a pretty cool, you know, inside analysis of how the process works, and you can hear how it just comes about in me telling the stories that way.
I'm going to grab that, actually. That's a good point. Going right back to the beginning then, I mean, do you remember the first story you ever wrote and what it was about?
Oh, absolutely. I remember I was 8 years old, and I made up my mind that I wanted to be a writer because I was watching, in fact, the big inspiration for me was H.G. Wells' The War of the Worlds, the film version of it from 1956, something like that. I saw that when I was just like a 5 or 6 year old kid, and it just blew me away. And I decided I wanted to be a writer and tell stories like that. And my dad had a typewriter. Remember a typewriter, sort of like a steampunk version of a laptop, sort of these old mechanical things that you would type. And I was 8 years old, and I went into my dad's office, and I used, he had a pile of pink scratch paper next to it. And I rolled in a piece of paper, and I typed a 3-page story over the next week or so called The Injection, about a mad scientist who creates an injection that will bring anything to life. And so, and then the other scientists don't believe him. So he goes and gets his revenge by, he goes to a wax museum and brings all the wax museum monsters to life. And then he goes to a natural history museum and he brings all the dinosaur skeletons to life. And they go on a rampage and attack the city. And this is when I was 8 years old. And that was my story, called The Injection. And I very much remember it.
Do you ever want some of your books to turn into screenplays and then films? Because, I mean, for me, when I read Saga of Seven Sons, the instant thing to me was, oh, this is a grand space opera, you know, and sci-fi, you know, back then it was kind of on a bit of a downturn. There wasn't really anything exciting, but now sci-fi seems to be making a huge return, especially with the investment in The Expanse and in Westworld and things like that, and Star Trek Discovery now. Do you ever think that something like Saga could turn into a giant space opera as a series?
Oh, believe me, I would love for that to happen. And I kind of get a kick out of, like, some of my fans writing saying, why don't you let them make movies out of your books? Well, that's not exactly the process that happens. I mean, the Saga of Seven Sons is, thanks to The Expanse, which I love, by the way, I love the books and I love the TV show. It's a good thing and a bad thing as far as I'm concerned with Seven Sons, because The Expanse has proved that you can make a big space opera and do a great job at it. But on the other hand, they've already got one, so they might not want to do another one that's also a huge, big epic like that. But because of the new Dune film, which is coming out on December 18th, supposedly, is our current projection from Legendary Pictures, that'll be a gigantic hit, I hope. Everything looks really terrific. And maybe the Dune thing will trigger some other works of ours. But to get back to the point of, an author doesn't just sit back and turn down giant movie offers day after day after day. Writing a book is one thing. You put the words down and you got a manuscript, and then a publisher publishes it. Making a movie, you're talking about minimum tens of millions of dollars or hundreds of millions of dollars. And I'm not quite at the point where I can fund something like that personally just yet. So it's a gigantic project. It's the difference between, say, pitching a tent and building a skyscraper. And in order to get a movie made of something, a great many pieces have to fall into place. And somebody has to believe in the project enough that they're going to plunk down a great deal of investment money. And you know, we do have people expressing interest, and it's like the old fairy tales about chasing fairy lights in the forest and running after these glittering things and hoping that something will happen. But I'm an optimist, and we always keep hoping. And Hollywood, you have to get your foot in the door and get one thing made. And once you get the first thing made, then other things seem to come easier. So we're hoping. I would love to see Saga of Seven Sons developed, and you know, we are working on it. We just haven't quite found the person with $100 million to hand us yet. Now, let me go back. I wouldn't be making it all. I wrote the original books, and somebody else would be producing it. Somebody else would be directing it. Somebody else would likely be writing the scripts. Although I hope at some point they'd let me write one episode. If you paid attention to Game of Thrones, George R. R. Martin, who wrote the books, I think he only wrote one or two of the scripts of the entire series. I'd have to verify that, but my memory is that he only wrote one or two. And George is an accomplished scriptwriter. I mean, he had many TV episodes produced before those books were published. So it just all depends on where the pieces fall. But I'm just happiest being a writer. Although in these days, like I said, I spend a lot of time going to comic conventions and doing public speaking gigs, and I'm now a professor at a Colorado university where I teach a graduate program in publishing. People can get a master's degree in publishing through my program. So that's another income stream. And I teach writing workshops, and we've got a pretty significant one called Superstars Writers Seminars that we're in our 12th year now that we hold every single year. And we get, I think, about 250 attendees for that one. So that's yet another thing that I'm doing. It's not the days where I could just write books and get paid for them and then write another book and get paid for it. It's not as easy to make a career doing only that these days.
You know, we're both on Twitter, and I see people commenting that on the same thing, which is, you know, they can't solely create an income stream to live off purely from writing books because the returns are quite low, and they often have to do other things or top it up with Patreon, for example, to do other things like small writing workshops or little lectures and things like that. So
we keep thinking about the good old days and stuff, but it has never in history been easy to make your living as a writer. It's just being different every single year. And I remember my first book was published in 1988. And at the time, I remember people saying, oh, this is the worst time ever to get into writing. It's just such a terrible time, and it's so difficult to make a living at it. Well, if it was easy to make a living at it, then I guess everybody would be, well, it seems like everybody is doing it, but I don't know how many people are making a living at it. It's always been, I like to compare being a professional author as in making your living or a substantial part of your living through writing and selling books as very similar to being picked for a professional sports team. You know, everybody wants to play on a football team, but very, very few of them actually get to do it for a living. Well, being a best-selling writer is, you know, I don't know the exact numbers, but I would guess that being a best-selling writer is about the same level of statistical probability as being picked for a professional sports team. I mean, there aren't that many people who are selling millions of copies and hitting the New York Times bestseller list. And there aren't that many people who are playing professional sports either.
You teach at Colorado University?
Yeah, it's Western Colorado University, and it's a whole graduate program in publishing. It's I created it myself. We're finishing up our first year with our first cohort of graduate students. And that was really kind of neat because I've had pretty good success both in traditional publishing and published with Tor Books and Simon & Schuster and HarperCollins. And also I run my own publishing house, Wordfire Press, and we've been doing a lot of indie publishing with ebooks and print on demand and audiobooks and all the new model stuff. So I developed this program from scratch about it's evenly balanced between traditional publishing and indie publishing. And I teach the students about copyright and contracts and marketing and ebook formatting and file protection and cover design and interior design. We have some of guest speakers from all over the industry. And we have, hands-on projects where they're producing a professional anthology that they're going to release. Each one of them is reprinting an old classic book as their solo thesis project. And I'm just very pleased with the program. And this first year was sort of the test run, and it's turned out just wonderfully. And it's called Western Colorado University. And you just type in publishing and Western Colorado University in Google, and you'll find it. But it's all online except for a 2 weeks in person in Colorado in the beautiful mountains in July. But thanks to COVID-19, this year's in-person thing has also been shifted onto a virtual situation. So we've got a lot of interest in people, even from the UK and from all around the world in coming. If you're interested in it, we're still open for applications for a couple more months. And it is all online, except for we hope next year we'll be back to normal. So July of 2021, you'd have to spend 2 weeks in the mountains. But it's very useful. It's unlike any other program that I know of that's out there, because a lot of the existing graduate programs in publishing were kind of written a while ago, and they're they're basically about how to get a job working in New York publishing or London publishing or something. And I don't think that that's where the focus is going to lie in the coming years.
No, a lot of it has turned into self-publishing or EPUB to be published on Kindle or even print on demand through various sources, you know, Amazon being one of them, obviously. You also mentioned that you do writing workshops as well. Has there ever been, there must be a lot of times where you've had people in the workshops, for example, and you've seen their narrative style or their sort of example of world building come to life, and you've thought, wow, that is just someone who I know for a fact is going to go somewhere with this.
Well, yeah. In fact, I have many, many writing students by now because I've been teaching for quite a while, but there are some times that the people really shine with their talent as far as writing a novel or writing their short stories. But there are other people who really shine as far as their marketing geniuses, their social networking prodigies, and they just know what they're doing, and they're brilliant at figuring out a cover design or getting their newsletter or promoting their work. So it's almost falls into two categories that you almost never find a juggernaut who is the most brilliant writer ever who also knows how to sell her stuff. Unfortunately, if you write the most brilliant book, but nobody knows about it, you're kind of defeating the purpose. And so I try to look for people that have a spark of both, because you really want them to tell a great story so that you stand out above the noise. But you also have somebody that doesn't just say, well, I've written my book, why doesn't it magically sell all by itself? Well, because that's not the way it happens, especially now with so many people indie publishing. Like everybody feels like if they could type enough pages that they could just put it up on Kindle and go, where's my $1 million check? So you want somebody who is, I guess, basically both a physicist and an engineer. So somebody who understands the theory, but also understands the practicality. And those people, finding somebody with both sets of skills is a real challenge. And sadly, it's the other way around. The brilliant marketers tend to be more successful than the brilliant writers. If you tell a great story, it doesn't have to be a Nobel Prize winning of literature. It doesn't have to be a Pulitzer Prize or anything. It just has to be a great story to entertain the readers. And if you know how to find an audience for it, you know how to make an interesting person of yourself. If you're active on social media, if you've got a newsletter, all of these things are more of a key to success than just telling a brilliant turn of phrase. And I know there are some people that just hate to hear me say that, but hey, look, it's my automatic doorbell. It's making a beautiful little fantasy chime here. So sorry about that. It's real life. We're sitting here in my office in fact, the cat's using the cat box in the corner right now, too. So it's the glamorous life of a best-selling author going on here.
So you've written for comics and games as well as books. Do you find that each medium requires a different approach to narrative design and world building, or is it pretty much transferable across any medium?
Well, games are a bit of the outlier because games are pretty much, the main part is the world building, because you got to build this whole world so that you can turn players loose to go all over the place and it all has to hold together. Obviously, in novels, you have that part, but also there is a defined plot that goes from point A to point B and tells the story. Comics is similar, that you have to have the defined plot. But comics also has to be visual, because if you're just looking at word balloons all over the page, then you might as well be reading the text book. The project that I'm working on right now is a three-volume, scene-by-scene adaptation of Frank Herbert's novel Dune. Brian Herbert and I are working on it for Abrams' book. It'll be like the definitive graphic novel adaptation of Dune. And so I'm just finished the first draft of volume two. And the novel Dune itself is broken up into three parts. So it's each graphic novel will be each part of Dune. And I think that, I mean, to me, Dune is the most brilliant science fiction novel of all time. I've read it probably 19 times over and over again. I just love it. But doing comics, you have to have big, sweeping, beautiful vistas and panels and things. And the novel Dune was not written for comics. There is so much internal dialogue, so much background information, so much discussion, so much static scenes where Paul and Jessica are sitting in the desert or they're sitting in a cave with the Fremen and trying to make that visually interesting as a comic, as opposed to how Frank wrote it as a brilliant novel. It's two completely different skill sets. And that's, it's quite a challenge to find ways to show the images of what appeared in my imagination when I was reading it. And you know, Dune itself has become, this is no pun intended, but it's become legendary because legendary is the movie company making the film, but it's legendary in its difficulty to film because it's so dense and there's so much information and so much cerebral stuff and politics. And so by doing this graphic novel adaptation, it has really given me an appreciation for how to convert it to a different medium. And it is not a simple project. And I had to work very hard to make it something that looked interesting. And Brian and I are going over the polishing and editing the script for volume two right now. Volume one is supposed to be released in October, I think, in hardcover as a graphic novel.
That's before the film then. So that's almost like teeing up for the film's release in a way.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of moving parts going on. There will be various, the graphic novels of Dune, there'll be various, some games coming out and everything. It's been 25 years, I think, that Brian and I have been working on trying to get something going with Dune in the film arena and some other things. So it's a very, very, very long startup, but it'll finally be, we hope, quite a successful explosion coming out later on this year.
So you've written for Dune, you've written for Star Wars novels, you've written for X-Files as well. Is there a particular franchise that you hold dearest? I don't know whether I'm teeing this one up for Dune at all, because you did say that you've been working, you know, with Brian for 25 years on that particular saga, but is that the defining kind of franchise for you, or did you have a lot of fun with any others?
Well, I mean, every one thing leads to another. It's sort of all interconnected. And Star Wars was my first big break. And that when I got invited to work for Lucasfilm, I had published a few of my own original novels, but I got to the attention of Lucasfilm and they asked me to write some Star Wars books. And that suddenly catapulted me into having a million copies sold and seeing my books in bookshops everywhere and in airports and train stations and grocery stores. And that built up a large fan base for me. And it also taught me a great deal about writing, because Star Wars is so colorful and so iconic and so humorous, and the heroes are larger than life. And I just learned a great deal about writing popular fiction from that. And I still have so many great fans from Star Wars and so many people appreciating it. And it's because of the Star Wars work that Chris Carter of the X-Files came to me and asked me to write X-Files stuff, which brought me a different group of fans and a different type of writing, which I've used for many other thrillers and many other some supernatural dark fantasy stuff. And all of that led to Dune, and Dune was my favorite science fiction book of all time. So that seemed to come full circle. The chance to get to work on Dune was just amazingly gratifying for me. And Brian Herbert is, like I said, I've known him for 25 years or so. He's one of my best friends, and we still work really well together. And I just enjoy our creative sparks that go back and forth. And of course, now seeing the long-awaited payoff of all this other Dune stuff in development is very gratifying. But I'm fortunate in that I'm prolific in that I don't just write one book a year and, you know, basically put all my eggs in that one basket. While I was writing the Dune books, I was with Brian, I was also writing the Seven Suns books on my own. And I was writing some steampunk fantasy novels with Neil Peart, the drummer from the rock group Rush. And those I just love and I'm very thrilled with. And then for something completely different, I would write my very corny Dan Shamble zombie private investigator books, which are sort of laugh out loud stupid, like Spaceballs and the Naked Gun movies. And I just like to keep myself entertained and do all sorts of different things. And then of course there's running the publishing house and running Superstars Writing Seminar and teaching my grad program at Western Colorado University. It's not a dull moment. I can say that. And that was all before the pandemic swept over the world and changed everything.
Is there a franchise that you would love to write for?
You know, I've been asked that a lot. And back in the 90s, when, I mean, the whole field of media tie-in fiction had sort of its heyday in the 90s, when there was novels based on various comics, and there were novels based on games and novels based on TV shows. And every movie that was released practically had its paperback novelization version. And I wrote the novelizations for League of Extraordinary Gentlemen and the Supernova and some other science fiction movies and Sky Captain and the World of Tomorrow. So I did tons of things on sort of my favorite shows. I did some work for Star Trek. And, you know, the thing I'm kind of very proud of is I did a couple of novels with Superman and Batman. And I grew up reading them. I really got into those characters. And I wrote a novel called The Last Days of Krypton. And I wrote another one called Enemies and Allies about the first meeting between Batman and Superman and during the Cold War in the 50s. And I just, as a fanboy, I just really got into doing those. But right now, I'm just so overloaded with deadlines and projects on my list of things to do and books I want to publish and books I want to write. And so I haven't given a whole lot of thought to pursuing something else that I haven't done yet. But, you know, if something comes up, I'll always consider it. But I'm not sitting around like we see some of these news stories about people who are so utterly bored in their stay-at-home lockdown situations. They don't know what to do and how do they occupy themselves. And I just kind of roll my eyes because my plate is still so full. And as soon as I finish something, there's just another comic idea or a short story I want to write, or I've got more chapters to do. And if that doesn't work, then I've got social media and I've got a readers group and a newsletter that goes out to my various fans. And in fact, anybody wants to sign up for that, you get a free collection of all the Dan Shamble zombie PI stories. It's at wordfire.com. So it's WORDFIRE, wordfire.com. And you get a free book out of it. And now that I'm home, one of the things that I think I'm going to start doing maybe next week is I'll start reading some of my short stories, just recording the audios and then giving away some audios. Like, here's Kevin reading you a bedtime story. Then that'll go out to anybody who's on the readers group. So we find things to do, and we've always had so much to do and not enough time to do it. And now maybe there's a little bit more time to catch up. And I keep thinking of more and more things to do. So I like it that way. I don't want to be bored or depressed. That doesn't seem to be in the offing for me.
An active mind is a healthy one. Just to sort of bring this full circle then, Kevin, is there anything that you have seen in the news or anything of general interest that is not book or certainly not pandemic or coronavirus related that you want to bring out for the audience attention? Anything inspirational, for example?
Well, one of the really interesting things I've been thinking about is I way back from my time in university days, I've loved reading Stephen King's books. I read them when they first came out. I read Salem's Lot and The Shining and The Stand and all this stuff. And it struck me that right now the whole world is basically living in two Stephen King novels. Like they're living in The Stand, because that the whole Captain Trips and the flu, and it's affecting everybody and sweeping around the world and watching how society changes and collapses as this epidemic goes. Every time I read The Stand, it feels like everybody around me is coughing and sneezing and getting some kind of cold. So The Stand is a great connection. But the other one is The Shining, because The Shining is all about how people are stressed and they basically go bonkers when they have cabin fever and they're locked up and isolated in a place and they can't interact with normal society. And there are so many people now, I'm surprised that I haven't started seeing news reports about people losing it and just going nuts and massacring their families because they're locked up in this little apartment with husband, wife, kids, dogs, bottled up and unable to do anything. Knowing human psychology, it would seem to me, and I'm not wishing for this, but it would seem to me, people are going to start getting cabin fever fairly significantly because they can't go out. And I'm very lucky in that I'm stuck at home with my wife of 29 years, and we're used to being at home together with each other, and we like each other, so we're having a good time. But think about the families who are used to being at different jobs all day long, and the kids are in school, and they come home and spend a couple hours at night together. Now instead, they can't even go outside. They're locked, and the pressure just might be getting more and more. And I worry about stuff like that happening. Although I worry about a lot of things these days, because I don't even want to predict how society is going to change in 6 months or a year. I mean, we can't predict how long this is going to happen. There's a lot of talk about, because everybody's so anxious to get back to normal and to open up all the shops and restaurants and pubs. And I would love that too. But if you open it up too soon and you got people spreading the COVID around, well, then we're going to be right back where we were before. And just this morning I saw in the news that, and I forget the number, I think we're over 30,000 deaths right now in the U.S. We got more deaths in the U.S. than any other country around the world, supposedly. And that's just not something you can get your head around. It's all sweeping through, and we don't want another surge of this to be coming back. But on the other hand, think of how many businesses are going to die. How many people are just not going to be able to afford to buy food anymore if they can't go to work, and they can't go to work through no fault of their own because they're told to stay home. I guess maybe a lot of people are spending the time to write their great American novel or their great novel that they've been planning to write for so long because they now have time to do it. I'm actually going to clean the garage for the first time in 10 years. I do worry about the, as a world builder, and that's the thing I do best, I think, in my fiction, is building up all these societies and worlds. And I just think about not the first order consequences, because those are easy, but the second and third and fourth order consequences are the things that I think are going to take us all by surprise, because whoever imagined that now that we suddenly have to teach school online because kids can't go to school anymore, that might change things forever for education, because there are actually some more efficient ways of doing it this way rather than herding everybody into a room and trying to get their attention for 45 minutes and then going back, that there may well be some significant changes. I'm concerned about the future of cinemas and motion picture movie theaters, because now we all get to stream to our TV at home. And frankly, I kind of like sitting in bed and watching a movie rather than going out and being all crowded in a theater and giving up 5 hours of my life to see a 2-hour movie when you add all the travel time and everything. So I'm kind of getting off on a tangent here, but there are so many things that may be fundamentally different a year from now. And we can guess, but we can't really know what it's going to look like.
I think, and it's been covered on a couple of podcasts already, but I think it's a great accelerator. The pandemic has been, because it has almost forced a lot of change to happen all at once rather than it being slowly drip-fed over years or decades.
Right, and there will also be brand new services. Of like right now, we use a utility called Zoom when I'm teaching on my classes, and I had used it before. It's sort of a Skype and video conferencing service, and I had used it, but I didn't use it all that often. Well, now they've become like the gold standard. That's what so many people are using. You're on Zencastr right now for doing this, and those kind of services, which were sort of a interesting convenience before, now become absolutely necessary. And banking, we used to have paper checks when somebody would send us a payment for a short story or something. We would physically take that paper check down to the bank and wait in line and you endorse it, and they would put it into our account. Well, we don't do that anymore just because nobody wants to stand in line at a bank. So now and this has been available for plenty of time. You take a photograph of the check with your phone and you electronically deposit it, and you never have to face a person. You never have to hand them the physical check. And obviously that's way more efficient than driving down and doing it. We just never had the impetus to do that before. Well, now we do, and I don't think we're going to go back to the old way of doing things. But there will be as many new innovative things filling the niches in business and society that they will come up, and people will become millionaires because they're the ones that came up with the solution to something that we didn't even know was a problem before. Whereas the old school, I heard there's a company called Diamond, which is the distributor for all comic books, the paper comic books that go to the comic book shop where people would stand around and flip through the comic books and pull out the new Spider-Man or the new Justice League or something like that. Well, that distributor just stopped distributing for the next several months because they can't get the comics printed and they can't get the comic shops open. Well, people who want to read comics are now forced to read them like on their iPads or something to look at the electronic version. Do you think that all those people are going to go back to standing in a comic shop and flipping through the paper comics and pulling them up again? Some will, because it's something that, I mean, I like to have a physical comic in my hand and look at it. But I think the industry is going to be fundamentally changed, and there will be those who are mammals who evolve, and there are those who are dinosaurs that just look at the asteroid coming. And I would rather be a mammal.
No, good way of putting it. Kevin, just to sort of finish this one off, where can we find out more about you? You mentioned your website, wordfire.com. Anywhere else that we can find out more about you and the writings that you've done and the books?
Sure. Wordfire.com is where you can sign up for the newsletter, get the free collection of stories and a bunch of other stuff. I'm on Twitter. It's the word the with my initials, KJA. So it's at the KJA. And if you go on Facebook, just search for the official Kevin J. Anderson page. And that's where I post all kinds of pictures of my hikes and of my cats and of my new books and whatever else. And I'm doing various podcasts. And I think I already mentioned the Western Colorado University, and then type in publishing and you should be able to find the grad program if anybody's interested in getting a master's degree. Superstars Writing Seminar is our big business-oriented writing conference, and that's in next February. So the whole world will be completely back to normal by then. So you can come for that. And that'll just keep you up on the various things that I'm doing. And it's, like I said before, it's a blue sky day out in Colorado. The snow is melting, and I might go out for a nice walk this afternoon. It's time to do another chapter in one of my books.
Sounds absolutely blissful. Kevin, thank you very much indeed for joining me.
Thanks, Theo. Glad that we could finally do this after all this time. We should do it at least once every 10 years.
Well, that about wraps it up for this particular episode of We Didn't Start the Fire. You will find this podcast available on Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcasts, and others. Please spread the word and subscribe. Until the next time, goodbye.